Hi guys, this is Andy. Today's episode is the first of a new series titled The Bible Sandbox. This is obviously a Zoom between Rick and Rick, and it seems like Mr. Welch has internet problems. But fortunately, Mr. Carter is talking most of the time, and he sounds good. I hope you guys enjoy. Bye.
The Burrows of Berea is a conversational podcast.
We study the Bible and we talk about it.
Not all of us are of the same faith.
And one of us doesn't have a faith.
But we still love one another. And we're going to continue to talk about these things.
The things we believe in and the things we believe about what we read in the Bible. Not all of these are necessarily true. Some of it is opinion and speculation. Thank you for
listening and speculating with us.
There you go. That was good. Yes. Stomps.
You are listening to the Burrows of Berea.
All right. Well, welcome back to the Burrows of Berea. I am Rick Welch, and across the waves of the internet.
Across the wave of our monitors.
Is Rick Big Daddy Carter.
Oh, yeah. Should have some Christmas sounds in the background. Maybe get all Andy can help us.
You should try the, what was it? What was that guy's name? Louis Armstrong. Oh, yeah.
See, you do it so well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
Oh, yeah.
So you and I, this is going to be fun. This is something that you and I do on a regular basis that no one knows about because we don't really, you know what I mean? Like, we do this all the time.
Dude, if we recorded the hours that we spend on the phone, mm-hmm. just the hours, we'd have so much content, it'd blow people's mind.
I know.
Never run out.
I know, but this, so we're kind of inviting you into our little mad little world that we like to play in. We're calling it the Bible Sandbox. And here's what the Bible Sandbox is, guys. This is a place where you can come and you can let your mind run. You can play. You can think. We can't say think outside of the box because we're going into the sandbox to play. Yeah. We're building up our little castles. We're thinking about things and running with it, uninhibited by doctrinal error that people are going to say or yelling and screaming or the church. This is just talking about things that we think of or that we see, and we kind of like dig. And what we've discovered by doing this is that although not all of it can be true, we find cool little nuggets and we're wait, that's legit. Like, that's legit. Gosh.
Yes. Yes.
And so the topic we're going to be talking about today, I think as we get ready to kick it off, the one verse that you sent me, I'm going to read the verse you sent me, Rick.
Okay.
And then I'm going to let you just hammer down, son.
Son.
And just so you know, whenever people, if people don't know, this is the kind of stuff that I get from Rick Carter.
Sons. Bumper says, when we think of somebody or get mad about something, that's what we holler to each other. And we just laugh. We don't get angry. We just laugh. But even though I was saying pompouses, not bumpuses.
You were saying pompouses.
Yes,
Rick. And I, of course, I had to correct you as always. Yes, that's the way I am.
I can't spell. I can't speak half the time.
Yes. All right. Isaiah chapter 64, verse 10 says, "Your holy cities are a wilderness. Zion is a wilderness. Jerusalem, a desolation." Then Jeremiah 4:11 says, "At that time it will be said to this people and to Jerusalem, a dry wind of the desolate heights blows in the wilderness toward the daughter of my people, not to fan or to cleanse." So why does that verse matter so much to what we're going to be talking about today, Mr. Carter?
Oh, my goodness. When you're sitting there, a lot of times when I will sit and I listen to a sermon or I listen to somebody speak, even with you, when we're sitting and I'm driving along as much as I do when I travel, just think, I'm constantly just rolling and thinking, putting the story in my head, playing it out like it was a movie. Because I grew up as, you know, a young kid, I watched a lot of movies, of movies. So my mind, coming from my childhood, works sort of like putting everything into a movie script or a movie play, and I just play it. And when somebody hits something or will get into a certain area with scripture or talking about a perspective of something, then I'm trying to put well, I'm like, will that fit into the my movie mind? Will it, or is that a, will that work? So I was, we're kidding, in this particular case, and I got to give a little credit to Zach Davis on this one, because he helped find this verse, because we were prior to, this has been a little while now.
In several months.
Yes, but it was back in March. He was doing a study, and right now I can't even give the credit of where this came from, but one thing that I will say that I have been working against in my theological mind is trying to break the boundaries or the casing that our sandbox, my mind sandbox is in about the traditions of the stories of what the Bible says. Because I have been working through a lot of different things and looking at words in the context. When I began, it actually, this is where it started from. It started from, and I've shared this with Rick now, I went through and charted out the Synoptic Gospels. And I went through, took each book, and then charted them against the other books to see where the context of what they're talking about fits with the other writers. And going back also even a little bit further and giving a little given a nugget to what's the guy, the one that was with about the diamond and the facets, Rick, help me with that.
Kim Burgess,
he gave a great analogy,
illustration of,
illustration of looking at the Bible and looking at it from different facets. So the charting of the each Synoptic Gospels, it was a way for me to look from the perspective of each writer. Now I could look at all the other writers and see where they fall. And, you know, for, I don't know if you've got time to pull it up on your screen so you can hear me talk about it.
Talking about the email you sent me?
I did. I sent the second email I sent you really quickly.
Yeah, I'll get it, and I'll put it up there. So you want which attachment? Do you want the Luke? Do you want John? Or do you want Mark? Or what?
Well, let's start with Mark, just so you can sort of see from a general perspective.
Let me share my screen. Just give me 1 second. All right.
All right. So each column, and for the listeners, and I'm sorry you can't see this.
For the listeners, what I'll do, here's what I'll do for the listeners that are hearing this. If you'll go to www.burrowsofberea.com, I will have a section called Bible Sandbox, and you'll be able to click into that link and pull up these presentations. So right now we're looking at the Book of Mark charted. This is what Rick Carter did on his own.
So you've got each book, the starting book is on the left, and then going from left to right, like we would read a normal novel, you could see where they fall along. And I've also got the chapters and the verses written out. And you can see, based on from starting at chapter one all the way down to the end of the book, you can see how the other books follow along. And some of the storylines, like you get down to in chapter three of Mark's book, Jesus healing in the synagogue for the second time, over in that's from Mark's book. Did I chart that wrong? Oh, sorry, you did the Mark book, not Matthew. Talking about it wrong. You opened up the Mark book, which is fine.
You want me to go to Matthew?
Let's stay on Mark. Sorry, listeners. He opened the charted Mark book, and that's not a bad book to, because I consider that the first book. That's where I started. So in chapter three, it's in chapter three of Mark's book, but if you go to Matthew's book, the healing of the synagogue in the second time, if you look, it actually is in chapter 12 of Matthew's book. So if you're looking at it from that perspective, I was kind of wondering, I'm like, okay, if these things are kind of in a chronological order, they're kind of bouncing around a lot. And you're going, well, you know, where do they fit in the timeline of what these guys are saying as far as and all of these are about Christ and all the things revolved. So it started to get my mind in a completely working perspective. And then if you look over in the far right, that's John. And everything that I, in these charted sections, and I've marked them in orange, those are in the original book on the left is where something is written. But in the other books, I've marked it in orange where they do not show up. the other writer didn't write about it. So it's missed.
What we're looking at is we're looking at a spreadsheet that's done on Excel. And in column A, you've got the Book of Mark events. Then in column E, we have the Book of Matthew events. Column I, the Book of Luke events. And then John in column M. And then beneath it, he has chapter one. You know, and what, here's the events, like John the Baptist, chapter 1, verse 1 through 8 in Mark, where it's chapter 3, verses 1 through 12 in Matthew, or in the book of Luke, it's chapter 3, verse 1 through 20. It actually extends. So he's done a good job. And you've probably seen things like this because they have these mapped out charts of the synoptic gospels. But this is something that Rick did on his own. And by doing so, it made his brain go on fire. He started seeing some stuff.
I did. And I started seeing some stuff. So we'll get back to just and what's so really interesting about John that I'll say, because we're looking at the spreadsheet, comparing the first three synoptic gospels to John, you're almost wasting your time.
Yes.
There's almost nothing there to compare between the, from John to the other three. Now, when we talk about the facet of the diamond of the of scripture, if you go in and you look at the charted book of John against the other ones, you begin to see a bunch of other stuff that John has now written in his book that doesn't follow along with the other synoptic gospels. So you begin to wonder, and this is where when I got into John is where I started having some major, like, wait a minute, what is going on? Why is John writing about stuff in his book that there's a lot of it not included in the first three? Why would he be writing about things? Now, this dates back a little bit again. And for my movie mind to put all these things together, there's a lot of, I would have, at the end of my movie, I would have a huge credit script. And it would have so many names with so many people that are pivotal in my movie making ability, where they played a role or added a piece to my movie. And, you know, Rick's, he's at the top because he's helped me, at least when we talk about things, he's allowed me to constantly play in a sandbox and not let me feel that I'm always messing things up, because, you know, despite the fact that I may have built something out of sand and it doesn't stand up real well, some things I can build up and it's very strong because, you know, over time I've been able to make it, the sand harden, and I've added some water to it. I've done some other things, and he looks at it and goes, you know, this stuff's starting to stick together. It's looking really good right here.
Yeah. Eventually it's no longer a sandbox. It becomes a rock block. Start building our foundation upon a rock, and you start, you know, it really gets strong. And that's some of the stuff that we have talked about, you know, for a while there. I was like, I don't know. And then after a while, it's like, well, wait a minute now. There's something here. There's something that's going on, and it's obvious, you know. So, whoops, sorry about that. Do you still need the screen?
Nope, you can go.
All right, I'll stop sharing that.
Yep.
So when I read those two verses earlier about the wilderness to you, right? Yep. The reason I brought those up was because I told you that when you start telling this story, we got to start somewhere. We got to have some kind of a verse. So when it talks about Zion and Jerusalem as a wilderness, you've charted all these books out. You start to see this. What on earth do you think is going on with the wilderness? And what do you think John, or let me just forget that. What do you think is going on with the wilderness? Let's just sandbox this baby.
Well, from what I've been able to look at, and I did when I started to read the Synoptic Gospels in comparison, because around the baptism of Jesus, they all kind of link together a little bit. And I started to, and linking back to a previous study and just many discussions that you and I had about who the author of John was. And the author of John,
I believe, is Lazarus, right?
I've said that many 100%, times. Yep, many times. And I agree with all my being now that it had to be him, and the connection that Lazarus had to the temple in one way, shape, or form. It's not extremely clear who he is, other than I have recently been told that Lazarus's father was a carpenter. I can't validate that, but I was recently told that his father was a carpenter like Jesus's father was, Joseph, and they knew each other. So there's a possibility that they grew up in the construction world in Jerusalem, which Jesus was in Egypt for quite a long time. So I'm not exactly sure how that fits together, but I know based on looking at John that he did definitely have a connection with the temple. And so when I got to looking at this thing, the big thing that I had this, I wouldn't call it an epiphany, but my sandbox, I went, wait a minute, the wilderness, Jesus, the temptation. I'm seeing that this thing might be different than what I was told.
Yeah, tradition will tell you that he went out into the desert.
He went out in the desert, went out in the middle of nowhere. And
didn't eat or drink.
Yep. And so
he drank, but he didn't eat. Yep.
So you're sitting there thinking, and my tradition told me he was going to go meet basically a dude in a red suit with a pitchfork and horns and a tail, and some crazy things were going to happen. And he was going to be whisked around to here. He's going to be whisked around to there like he was on a magic carpet. And that, I mean, at the time it was nothing wrong necessarily with that, but as I'm sitting there thinking about it, I said, wait a minute. And there was a key point in reading in the scripture where it said that he was taken to the pinnacle of the temple. So I said, and I don't know why. I felt like you need to look that up. So I did a quick search and trying to find out what the pinnacle of the temple was. And it turns out it's a very tall place on the temple. It's an elevated plateau or porch where the priests would stand, and they'd look over the distance and they would wait for the sun to come over the edge of the horizon. And as soon as the sun crest, it was time to announce to the people down or to the priest to begin the morning sacrifices at the temple. So it was kind of like an alarm clock, so to speak, for the priest. So I got to sit there and think, I was like, wait a minute. So wait, let's go. So if that kind of fits, it's at the temple, that means there's a lot of people there. And this guy with a red suit and horns, Jesus is supposed to be meeting him. Well, how did nobody see that? Was it out of time where there was nobody there and they were just standing there?
Yeah, is it kind of like a vision? Is it a vision? Is that what's happening? Or
yeah,
did he literally take him up there? Right.
Yeah, did he really take him there? And there was no, because according to what I've researched on, there was always people there. There was always priests there looking. They were anxiously looking for the sunrise every morning. So it would be a populated area. And if it's in the temple, there's a lot of people there all the time. So I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. How in the world would that work out? So then I start thinking about, okay, let's put some other pieces together, almost like Dallas Jenkins does with The Chosen. A lot of his story is speculation to some extent, but there's enough context to put enough pieces together to draw a picture, a conclusion.
You're telling a story. You got to pull things together to tell a story. Otherwise, you're reading the highlights of the Bible. That's it. This is a storytelling thing, The Chosen, you know?
And it can be, if you try to do it by the highlights, it can be very boring.
Yes. Like most of the Jesus movies in the past,
yes.
This is what makes The Chosen so unique. It's really well written.
So this is, I'll kind of cut to the chase about where I think the story goes. And this is my sandbox, and I'm kind of drawing a conclusion. So Jesus is now getting to the point where he's getting close to his baptism. There's a group of people that are there. There's a main character that's played. His name's John the Baptist, which turns out to be his cousin. He comes across the hill to John the Baptist, which is the basically present day Elijah. He sees Jesus coming over the hill. There's a discussion that's had. He announces to the people there, there he is. There's the Messiah. Stands on the hill. He announces it to everybody. Well, when he announces it to everybody, I got to think, well, there's a lot of people there. Who's all there? Well, there's at least Andrew's there. I believe Lazarus is there because he writes about in his book. Because he was possibly, I don't know if he was there with Andrew or not, but Andrew was there. Lazarus was probably there because written in his book.
So in other words, what I'm saying is that we think that it's Lazarus and Andrew, but you're describing the scene where Jesus is about to be baptized.
Yep, he's coming over the hill. He announces to everybody, and there's some other key players that are in this thing that we miss out on, and it's the Pharisees and Sadducees are there. It's the religious people from the temple. And of course, we know that John the Baptist kind of angrily says, why did you leave your place of restitute? Because destruction is about to come to you. And Jesus gets baptized, but then he's led quote unquote, to the wilderness. And that's where, again, when you start to draw a conclusion, wait a minute, this is not working out. And then you start to pull some other pictures with, like, okay, the one thing that about the word, the devil, is later written by Paul. It's written in Hebrews. And it describes basically that the leadership of the temple is the devil. And I said, well, wait a minute. So if the leadership of the temple is the devil, then why would that definition of devil not be the same as the one in the original and not necessarily some fictitious person or entity? So what if those two fit together? And I went, wait a minute. You've got Lazarus there, which then continues to write about some of the things that are going on close to the temple. He's met with John the Baptist. John the Baptist, we know, is a Levitical of the Levitical priesthood, which would have put him at the date and time when he did it. He would have been working at the temple or had some time at the temple, depending on his, I've been also recently told, or within the last few months told, that they had a work schedule. Whether or not they were there 24 hours a day, who knows? But I know that John the Baptist was there. John the Baptist said he saw, basically sees Jesus. So I begin to start to draw this conclusion. So wait a minute. If Jesus didn't go into the desert, then that means he had to go to the temple. And he went to the temple to meet with Annas. Because at the time, Annas would have been the head priest. He'd been the main man.
Mr. Caiaphas.
Well, it had been one of the two.
Right, Annas or Caiaphas. And I think at that point, Anna, it depends. By the time you get to Jesus's ministry, I believe, I can't remember, but I think Caiaphas had already been a high priest for quite some time at that point.
Well, we can also back up the fact that when Jesus is arrested, which place does he go to first? When he's first arrested,
he goes to Annas first.
He goes to Annas. So,
who is the father-in-law of Caiaphas? I mean,
so there's a direct connection. And so, if there is, you bring in quote unquote the announced Messiah by John the Baptist, that has already been basically prophesied as being the current day Elijah. So, I'm sure that his word stood some pretty heavy weight to it. At least when he went to the temple, he met with leadership. He met with the high priest, which would have either been Annas or Caiaphas or both. He'd have met with them.
And so it's probably Annas, to be perfectly honest with you, because that dude, I mean, if you read Josephus, Annas was at the center of everything. He was kind of like the master of puppets, like with his little marionettes dancing around, you know?
So, which is also in Josephus, the story is when the war begins to come to the temple, the first thing to catch fire and burn down is Annas' house.
This episode is brought to you by Supply Chain Solutions.
Supply Chain Solutions is a third-party logistics company providing small to mid-sized businesses an outsourcing option focusing on warehouse management, customization of products, assembly, and packaging of goods, and has the ability to meet business-to-business and business-to-consumer fulfillment needs. Supply Chain Solutions continually strive to be their customers' most highly valued partners for quality, delivery, responsiveness, and customer service. To learn more about Supply Chain Solutions, you can visit their website at www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com. That's www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com.
And now back to the show.
Yeah, and so it's not a stretch if we do not fight against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities and rulers of this dark world. It seems like what Paul's talking about is those leaders of the church in Jerusalem, or not the church in Jerusalem, but the leader of the temple of Jerusalem,
right?
And what they were doing and how they were pulling the strings with Rome and all of that stuff. So in other words, what you're saying is that Annas is the devil in this story.
Is the devil in the story of what's going on. And just, okay, well, Jesus fasted. Well, all right. So if he's in the wilderness, you could say, yeah, he didn't have any food out there, but in most cases in the wilderness, you had trees, you had fruit trees, you had olive trees, you had different things out there to eat, but he literally starved himself. So then I got thinking, wait a minute. Jesus was actually born to the house of Judah. If he's at the temple, then that means he can't eat. He can't eat nothing. Because what's at the temple? Sacrifice and tithe. All of the fruit, all of the grain, all of the meat, all the stuff that was at the temple is all sacrifice. It would have been against the law for Jesus to eat any food at the temple. Then I got to think, wait a minute. If John the Baptist is Levitical, that means he's at the temple as well. But it's interesting that the writers tell us that he ate locust and honey. He didn't eat food there either. So he had to eat something outside of it that was safe to eat. So wait a minute. This stuff's pulling really together really strongly that they kept, if he is at the temple, they kept him there long enough to question him and try to, at least from the author's perspective, to define if he was. The amazing part is that Jesus basically nondescript didn't answer him, didn't give him a confirmation or deny, didn't confirm or deny the story of who he was. Because every answer the quote unquote the authors give us, he didn't say yes or no. Not really sure why they let him go. But in most cases, they didn't have anything for him. The other part is, did they actually know who he was? Because in the beginning of the story in Matthew, is that at the age of 12, during whether it was Passover or it was a festival, he's at the temple. He ends up he's missing for like 3 days because his Mary and Joseph leave. They can't find him, which is, you know, neither here nor there. They don't find him. They come back. They find him at the temple. What's he doing at the temple? He's teaching. He's doing his father's business, but he's also making an impression on the people there. Who the people he was making an impression on, we don't know, but I'm curious would be, did anybody later when he was back at the temple, if that so be it, during the temptation scene of the appointed people, this is the other part that's interesting, is that the devil tells Jesus that such has been given to me that I can give you control of everything.
Yep.
So those people were appointed by Rome, and they could appoint whoever they wanted. Roman, the Pilate and all those leaderships didn't care who the leadership of Jerusalem was. They could care less because they outranked them and overpowered them. You could have anybody. You could have a group of people. You could have a single person. It didn't matter to them. But just don't pay your taxes and don't create riots.
That's right.
Yeah, so absolutely. As a part of our sandbox story, I said, wait a minute. So wait a minute. Is my tradition wrong about the temptation scene? If my tradition tells me that, my tradition tells me this, and I put in time and effort and study and start to pull conclusions together that are not outside of the Bible's context, but give me factual things to stand on, then if that tradition is not right, then where else can my tradition lead? Where is tradition leading me where the story tells me something different?
What you're trying to tell the audience right now, or which you and I have talked about so many times, is the idea here is that when we read the temptation scene, that rather than thinking that he's out sitting in the sand by himself with nothing to eat, he actually goes to the temple, because by the time the Messiah arrives, the temple is a wilderness. And so the idea is that John the Baptist has already went into the wilderness, which is at the temple scene. He wears this Elijah-type clothing. He eats food that is not what the priests are eating, and eventually leaves. He leaves that place, and he goes out to the Jordan where he begins his baptism stuff. And then Jesus comes, goes to his baptism, and then he leaves and goes to the temple, which is a wilderness. And he starts talking directly, being tempted by the most powerful man in all of Jerusalem, who would be the devil or Annas. That's really how you're seeing this as a movie script.
Yes. And that he's yes. there being presented the offer that he'd offered. They offered him the kingdom, which would have been against the Mosaic law of appointing, which here's the funny thing. They're standing there, a not Levitical priest appointed over the temple, and they are offering him the same exact thing, to be leadership over the temple and not be Levitical. The wilderness and the depravity of where things were at was surmounting. And this is what's interesting, is we know that God said that the cup of sin was going to be fulfilled or filling up for Israel. One of the reasons how would that sin fill up? Well, just on the surface, in a simple answer, would be that they didn't have a correct appointed high priest to do sacrifices. So Israel was never being forgiven appropriately for anything for really, we're not sure how long, because we're not exactly sure when Rome started appointing priests to the temple, which at least from the scripture standpoint, we don't, of how long they've been going, where they haven't been performing sacrifices appropriately. And God had not been forgiving them for anything because they weren't doing it. And the Jews had now become an accessory to the sin that was going on because they were allowing it.
I mean, you have, so like you just pointed out, so let's talk about John the Baptist real quick. So we know, based on the scripture, that Zechariah, his father, was a Levite. Yes. We know that John was a Levite. So he was of true birth in the, you know, the Levite tribe, to where he would go to work at the temple. And his father went to work at the temple. And we know that. We can read that in scripture, that his father. Now, when you read the story about his father, he's in the temple during the time of whenever Rome had already started putting these people into power. Yep. Right. So,
and they had ruthless power.
Yeah. And you and I have done enough research to know that these people that they put in power were Edomites or Edomians, what we've learned, right?
Yes. And here's the when we did the research on the Edomites, where did that tie us back to?
Can't remember.
Esau.
Yeah. Sorry. Esau, Jacob and Esau.
Yep.
And Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. Yes.
Now, the interesting thing is you can't really define why God would have hated Esau. So what is it in this sandbox to say, was God saying that he loathed Esau because of Esau himself, or would it be the family would kill a son?
That's right.
That's why he hated Esau.
Mm-hmm. The foreknowledge of God already knew, as the plan would go, that this group are going to be the ones that are going to kill his son.
Yes.
Not realizing that they were getting ready to open up a can of whoop butt on themselves by doing so, because he would resurrect.
Yes. And you found some research that we did that gave some definition on Caiaphas about him being an Edomite, about how they had at that particular time had became almost like a mafia. Rome would be like Vegas, or Israel would have, the city of Jerusalem would have been like Vegas, and that Vegas would have been run by the mafia, which was the Edomites, which was Annas and Caiaphas in the ilk, and Herod of the ilk, that would have been running that place with some brutal might force. And how is it brutal? Well, remember, as much as in the time we're at now with Christmas, is that Jesus was born under a prophecy, under a significant event. You have three wise men that are gracefully showing up, asking where this new king is born in the place that already has power appointed to people. That person, Herod, decides that he doesn't want this born king to live. And he begins to send out his men to massacre children within a certain particular period of range of time. And the interesting thing is that one part that's really missed that I think is important to add into this is not only was Jesus being hunted for, but John the Baptist was of the same age and he would have been hunted at the same time.
And that is something that gets lost so easily. We don't think about John the Baptist because we're focusing on the Messiah. But John the Baptist was born 6 months prior to him, and he would have been in that age group during the Massacre of the Innocents. That is wild. That's wild. I don't know why we don't think about that.
Yep. And there's because of he was hunted, something happened. And I don't even know if we should say it here per se, but there was something
I think it's in the Gospel of Nicodemus that mentions this?
No, it's the Gospel of James.
That's right. The Gospel of James that mentions it.
The Gospel of James, which most people haven't read.
Because it's not canon. But we're sandboxing it. We're sandboxing.
So you have Zechariah, his father, that is actually in the temple during the period of time when the story is written. He's in between the altar and the Holy of Holies when Herod's men come to question him where Elizabeth was because he had a child that was born of the age of all the children that need to be killed. He would not tell Herod's men where Elizabeth was. Because he would not tell, they killed him in the temple between the altar and the Holy of Holies. Now, what is interesting is that Jesus in Mark chapter 23, where he's given the woes.
Matthew 23.
When Jesus is giving the woes, he tells them that the blood of all the way from the blood of Cain to the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah. Is that Zechariah the same Zechariah? Because Jesus says that Zechariah was killed between the altar and the Holy of Holies.
Yes, and that's where you and I have determined that because the Gospel of James says that he is the son of Berechiah, then if that's the case, then that's the one that Jesus is talking about. He's saying you're guilty all the way from Abel down to John the Baptist's father when you killed him.
Even though they didn't partake in anything to do with Abel, the heap of all of the sin was going to fall on that generation, which had to be a tremendous amount of weight placed upon them for the things that they would begin to do. And so, again, tradition doesn't go anywhere in this direction, but there is, as a private investigator would do, if you were charged with a crime, you would want a private investigator to do all the things necessary to draw a factual conclusion based on the evidence presented to declare you innocent. So as a studier or a scholar, well, I mean, I would say we're scholars because we're digging into this so much. As our scholarship works through the Bible, I'm beginning to, for me, find evidence of things that are factual, put those things together that can, for me, is beginning to change my tradition on what the Bible says.
Yeah, and that's just it. I mean, we have traditions that have been told to us. They're reading the scripture, they're reading it literally, and they're saying, this is what happened, and this is how we understand it. Jesus went out into a desert place, and he didn't eat, and he dealt with this dark, ominous figure that was doing all kinds of stuff in a vision. Well, that's a tradition. That's not necessarily what the authors are trying to do, because we already know that the authors are hiding and codifying certain information because they're trying to undermine the mafia.
Yes. The present the present day mafia to them.
Yeah. They're talking the code we've talked about, right?
They had to be. They had to be writing in somewhat of a code language. Because remember, they didn't have the internet to send emails. They didn't have telephones to make phone calls. Anything was written with a letter. Now, the interesting thing is when you mailed a letter, you sent it with a messenger. The messenger could be the decoder to the whole message. If you wrote out an eyewitness account of an event and you named names and you identified certain people appropriately to let other people know about a person or thing, if that letter got picked up along the road or anything got happened and somebody found it and it landed into the wrong hands, now you had legal evidence to search and hunt the person down that wrote it to kill them. So if Matthew that wrote his book, Mark that wrote his book, and Luke wrote his book, despite the fact that Luke is being paid to write to Rick, the guy that Luke was writing his book to before he wrote Acts.
Theophilus, who I believe is Theophilus ben Annas or Matthias ben Theophilus, who was a high priest.
Well, he's writing the stuff in there, but they're writing in there and they're putting certain words. They're not naming names and they're not putting significant things so that if it ever got picked up by, say, a Pharisee or Sadducee at any point in time between the point of it being delivered and transcribed, they would have legal evidence to, I mean, they already wanted them anyway because of the turmoil that they were causing based on all of the stuff that was going on. But you would have had legal evidence to really go after them. So why not write it in certain ways that it would have taken longer? The interesting thing, again, and this is where we expound on the recent discussion that you and I have had. I think it's a good point we start on there. As I've done this and I have studied, it really seems like Jesus, and we've talked about the mafia, Jesus is basically the 007 against the mafia. He's that undercover man that is constantly working in the shadows. Sounds very strange, but he's working in the shadows to work against the higher powers that be, the mafia, to basically be the Rudy Giuliani and come after them with RICO cases to shut them down.
He's taking them out, and he's doing it, you know, one little area at a time. You know, he's overthrowing certain sections of Vegas and screwing up their money.
He is. And they are. All right. So you think, well, tradition tells me that Jesus is sitting on a hill picking flowers. It's, you know, sunny days. It's great. He's teaching people. They're loving on him. It's all rainbows. And I'm sorry that this is probably a bad analogy, but the movie that I have pictured in my mind, it was so much more pleasant than when you go through and start looking at the story and go, man, this thing was not, it was not that nice.
Jesus is running for his life.
He's telling people not to tell him about him. When he healed him, he was specifically telling them, don't tell anybody I did it.
Yep. Keep it on the down low.
Keep it on the down low. So and I'm going to give a tidbit to Tiziana. This is interesting that in one of our podcasts, she mentions about, I'm not sure if we recorded it or not.
No, we did. She released it. It's about, are you talking about the decoys?
Yes.
Yeah. So, we definitely recorded that.
So again, tradition would not say this in this way I'm going to tell you, but when I started to look at the story of Jesus in this kind of 007 thing, is that Jesus creates in such a special way 12 men personally. This is, again, this is part of the sandbox. I think he picks 12 men that are about his height, that almost look close to him and have the same stature and built that he did. Because what does he do with those 12 men when eventually he sends them out with power, just like himself? He created 12 copies and then broadcasted them out. So you've been to think, so why would you do that? Well, remember, we went back to where there's no email, there's no telephone, there's no cameras. All you have is written letter that takes days to get from one place to the other. So if you've got 12 to 13 people out in cities and towns healing the sick, raising dead, curing the lame, doing all of these magnificent things and telling stories, because Jesus even said, don't worry about what you're going to say, because my Father is going to tell you what to say when you're going to say it. So he literally creates 12 copies, sends them out. From the temple standpoint, by the time the letter started coming in, it had to be ultimate chaos.
Like, Jesus is everywhere.
He is literally everywhere.
He's disrupting He's messing up our coke deals. He's messing up our meth deals. He's messing up all of our, you know, we're talking like a mafia, you know, like all of a sudden it's like, he's over there. He just screwed up that little gambling organization that we had over there. Oh yeah. Well, he's over here messing up my drug organization. Oh yeah. Well, he's over here doing, it's a nightmare for
and
these
guys. And he's
doing
it all at the same time.
Same
and
time.
You're thinking, how is this even possible? So as you're sending out, from a mafia standpoint of leadership of the temple, as you're sending out your little Pharisees and guys out to get reporting, they're doing their due diligence to come in and say, what is going on? And it's going to take time. And so you also get into, let's talk about real quick on the parables. This is what I've deduced about the parables, was that why did Jesus talk in the way that he talked in parables? Well, remember, he's already trying to hide himself. In my opinion, he's creating copies of himself. He sends them out. And now he's telling these massive, prolific parables to the common people, not to the religious people, but to the common people. But he's telling it in a certain way that the religious people don't understand. How don't they not understand? If you go back and look at each parable, he's talking about things that the religious leaders never did. They weren't farmers. They didn't raise cattle or sheep, or they didn't work out in the fields as sheep herders. They didn't do any of that type of work. All they did was stay in the temple and live fat and happy. So when somebody would finally tell a story of something like that, they'd have absolutely no clue what it meant until later. When Jesus is in the temple, one of the last parables that he talks about, he gets a little bit closer to what they were doing. He talked about leadership of the vineyard and how the vineyard, the leader of the vineyard, they knew management. They knew control and who was in authority and power. And he asked them at the end of that parable, he said, do you understand what I meant by this? And they said, yes. Now, the interesting thing that's kind of funny that I literally belly laughed out loud when I finally read it, was that Jesus looked at them and said, prostitutes and tax collectors are going to get into heaven before you guys do.
Yeah.
So he's coming after them in such a way that he's undermining, and he's, in my opinion, he's converting certain people at times in these temples, in these outer cities. He's converting people. He's changing their minds. He's affecting them based with all the power that he has proving with miracles about who his father was, where he come from. And the hard part is the disciples, they're even doing it and they don't understand it.
Amazing so, is that Jesus, even in his parables, he's telling the mafia exactly how he's going to take down Vegas.
Exactly.
He's telling them how he's going to do it.
He's exposing it and they don't see it. I mean, I don't know if it's time to do it today, but retelling of John chapter 3, where I already did it one time in a previous was Holy Moly Nicodemus, where Jesus is basically telling Nicodemus the whole story in a chapter, and nobody's figured it out. And if you look at John, the timeline where John is at in his, when he's, Lazarus is writing his book, Jesus, I think, has that discussion with Nicodemus when he's at the temple during the temptation scene.
Yeah, we've talked about how John is like out of time sequence. And it's just, you know, it's kind of going back and forth. But it seems like when he's having this talk with Nicodemus, we always think that it's super early. Like even if you watch The Chosen, he meets Nicodemus in season one. We think that meeting is actually in probably season six or seven is where it should be.
Actually, if you go back and look at it, I think it's at the early when he's at the temptation, right after the baptism.
Yeah.
I think it's early when he has that discussion with Nicodemus and has a later effect on it.
They don't even show the temptation.
No, not at all. They haven't gotten there yet. And we don't know if they will or not. That's a very interesting to figure out how the perspective. So one of the things that was interesting as I was sitting in Sunday school, and we recently talked about this, and I was looking at the trial of Jesus. And there was something that was mentioned, and I went, wait a minute. It's like stuff like this movie plays out. It just literally comes to me. It's not like I'm not even asking for it or wanting it. But as they're talking about it, I'm like, wait a minute. Nobody knows that Jesus was crucified. Nobody knows. So I go through this whole
thing. I'd say we've got about 15 minutes of this episode left, and I really, really want you to dig down deep into that, because as we sandbox, and we're going to have to do about three or four more of these because this is so big, so big. But what you just said about the crucifixion, it's kind of like the same idea about the decoy, right?
Yeah.
How he's sending himself out and he's creating this confusion. Well, then he allows, and it's foretold long ago.
Everything we talked about in our sandbox is all scripture based. It's all prophesied. It's all coming out like it's supposed to happen. We're not breaking any boundaries on that standpoint. We're just looking at the facts and bringing together the best that we can draw the conclusion together that what really happened.
So let's try to whet the appetite here for more Bible sandboxes, and take me on why, number one, Jesus was scourged the way that he was, and how this all is going to play out.
All right, we'll just kind of run with it. So as I'm sitting there looking, I went, wait a minute, nobody knows about it. So I started looking. I said, well, he started dealing with people. When he dealt with people, what was the reaction of the people? And there was a point in time leading up to the feeding of the 5,000. And this one line is written in John's book and nobody else's book. This is crazy. And that leading up to that point, he's telling everybody, don't tell them about me. Don't put my name out there. Don't say who I am. And then things begin to progress. And this is why I think his ministry had to be so short, is because eventually, if you're 007 and you're working behind the scenes, the longer you work at things, the more time the other person has time to figure it out. So he had to be fast. Plus, the effect that he was having on the common people leading up to the 5,000 feeding, at the end of that feeding of the 5,000, the common people, they want to, by force, place him as king over Israel. He's not even supposed to be king because he was not anointed, at least in a traditional sense that the past kings and everything else had been placed as king over Israel. They wanted to do it by force. Now,
he was of the tribe of Judah, and I think it's safe to say that he was of the lineage of David, so he definitely could have been. But by the time he was born, that had been done away with because Rome and all of those other major empires had disrupted Israel's lineage so terribly that it wasn't going to happen in that way. So at this point, he feeds 5,000 people, and then all of them are like, let's make this guy king.
Yes, they want to do it by force. So I went, okay, so where's the next big scene that they have of all the people? The triumphal entry. Mm-hmm. What did the people do for the triumphal entry of Jesus?
Yeah, they're shouting.
They're singing Hosanna. The king of the Jews. The king of Israel. They're shouting
it. The resurrection of Lazarus, by the way.
Yes.
And so all the people are there, and they're there for Passover. But what are they doing? They're not in the city. They're outside of the city, following him in, yelling and screaming like he's a king. And he's riding on a colt of an ass.
Yes. That was prophesied.
Yeah. He's the king. He's the incoming king.
And the interesting thing is that Lazarus, even though Jesus in the story of the rich man and Lazarus, or he says, Jesus says that even if I raise the man from the dead, you won't believe it.
Right.
But he's still raising from the dead. So if he raised him from the dead anyway, and nobody's going to believe it, what was the purpose? Leading up into the triumphal entry, Lazarus was part of the spectacle of Jesus together as the dynamic duo, Batman and Robin. They were the reason that all the commoners came to town.
It says it in the book of John. It makes it clear. The whole reason they're there is to see the man whom Jesus had raised from the dead. They weren't there just for Jesus. They were there for Lazarus.
So if they're there to see him, this is Passover coming up. Now, the question is, because Vegas had gotten so bad, had the commoners quit going to the temple or to the city during Passover? Had they stopped going? And Jesus needed to create something big enough to actually bring them into the city? I think it's so. Because they came to see those two people. Part of the sandbox. Had the commoners, because of the things that were going on that later gets revealed to the people when he brings them in. The other kicker to this that I think is great is Jesus uses the mass of people not only to bring them into the city as he needs them, he's using them as protection. How is he using protection? It's protection and control. How is he using it in protection and control? When he goes and confronts the religious leaders and makes them mad because he goes in and he starts messing with their money because he's running them off. Oh, the picture. The picture of Jesus standing with the whip in front of the temple that the Chosen just put up. Oh my gosh, man. As I sent that picture to you, I was like, there's so much going through my mind, Rick. You got to hear it. You got to hear it. He's standing in front of the temple, and as you look at it, you look like, okay, what person has a whip? And what's at the temple? He's like, well, a lion tamer would use a whip. And he's going there to tame the lions. Well, wait a minute. But that doesn't happen. If he goes to tame the lions, then Jesus doesn't die. Because he's tamed them. Jesus is going to aggravate the lions so that they do kill him. But they have to kill him in a certain way.
Certain time.
In a certain time. Because Jesus is now inside the temple. There's a mass group of people. One of the things that when he finally starts, and with the whip, he starts affecting their money because he's now pushing over tables, kicking them out of the temple, and now he's upset the entire economic system of the mafia. If you one thing you don't mess with when it comes to mafia is you don't mess with their money. They will kill you.
Yeah.
And Jesus has done exactly that. He's messed with their money. Well, why they would have, if it was a legitimate mafia man, he'd have just pulled out his gun and shot him in the head and it'd been done and over. And the story had been over. But the Bible says that the religious temple leaders would not go after Jesus because they were afraid of a riot.
Well, there were so many people surrounding him that believed him, that wanted to force him to be a king. I mean, this was a huge group, and the leadership was like, you know what? We can't fight again. And we see that today.
Yes.
You can see the effect of that today. A large population of people can make change in society.
Yes.
And that's what they were afraid of.
Jesus was forcing their hand, but he was also controlling how they used their hand.
Yep.
So Jesus now affected them. He's now caused them that they really want to go after him, but they're not going to do it out in the daytime. They come to him at night to arrest him. Yep. The interesting thing is when they arrest him, what happens to all the people that's with Jesus? Because they send at least 600 people to go arrest him on a mountain in the garden. They arrest him at nighttime with a massive group of people. Way outnumbered who he had. What happened to these people? They ran. They fled. So you basically have nobody there now. He's there by himself in the end. The only people that we roughly know that ever came back around after he's arrested and taken is he goes to Annas' house first. The story of John, which is Lazarus, keeps along with the story. If you look at the book of Mark and you look at the book of Matthew, they're very, very descript. And they're very general in how they say what happened. Well, I believe that both Mark and Matthew were heavily influenced by Peter. They, for one, to write anything down there, if it's a factual point, it's because they were written by Peter. Well, Peter made it to Annas's house, but he was outside in the courtyard. He wasn't inside the building. The book of John is more of a first-person perspective. That means that the writer was there. He was either there or he talked to somebody that was standing in the room when it happened. And the only connection that if Lazarus wasn't standing in the room, then he got the information directly from Nicodemus. And Nicodemus would have been there. So they go to Annas' house. They go that we know that Jesus gets slapped because they tell him that he's speaking against the high priest. And Jesus says, where's the high priest at? I don't see him. I don't see the big guy here. Where's he at? So they know they can't stand against him or accuse him of anything from a religious standpoint because they don't have anything against him, because the man that's the head, the leader, is not a legitimate leader. So they send him to Caiaphas, which is the true appointed high priest, even though he's not the real guy. So they send him over there. Lazarus and Peter go with him. But what's interesting is that when Peter gets to Caiaphas's house, he gets noticed by a little girl. And when he gets noticed by the little girl, which was prophesied to Jesus at the dinner table at Passover, and Peter is staunch about how much he's going to stand with Christ, but he doesn't. He leaves the scene crying. And this is on Wednesday. From Palm Sunday, this is Wednesday. Wednesday night into Thursday morning. And when the rooster crows, the rooster usually crows is first thing in the morning. So that's Thursday morning. Peter leaves crying. Now there is nobody there. So from the beginning of Wednesday and the Thursday morning, in that scene, there's nobody there. Jesus is by himself. You see a break in the story. We know that Jesus is now, because they can't put it, they can't get enough people to witness against him so that they could basically try him as a religious criminal within the temple to stone him. Now they send him to Pilate. Pilate meets with Jesus, has a discussion with him. His wife has had a bad dream about Jesus and says, you don't need nothing to do with this guy. So Pilate says, I don't want to do this. I'm going to send him to Herod, because this is kind of an Israel thing. This ain't me. So he sends him to Herod. He gets to Herod's house. Herod immediately, there's no discussion. Now, how come there's no discussion? Because Herod doesn't live near there. So the entire time from Wednesday, from Thursday morning till about Thursday evening, the entire day, Jesus is traveling to Herod's house and back. Well, he's traveling by himself because nobody writes anything. There's an entire day where there has to be, you have to have enough time. So they're passing him around. There's nobody there. Peter's gone. Don't really know where he's at. I think he's near Lazarus. Reason I think he's in Lazarus, and I'll speed up a little bit, is because the rest of the disciples outside of Judas is now has killed himself because he was there with the high priest. He was either at Annas' house or he's at Caiaphas' house, and he witnessed what they were trying to do to him. Now he gets him.
Judas doesn't kill himself until after Pilate condemns him. So Judas is still alive. Judas is over there arguing at this time, trying to give the money back.
And he knows it's serious.
Yeah, because at this point, this is bad. Now this turned out not like what he expected. So Judas is arguing the point between twilight at night until daylight the next day. Judas is trying to get out of what he had put into motion.
Until he threw the money into the temple. Now his discussion had to have happened probably by Thursday morning.
Yeah.
And he first meets with Herod. He throws the money in the temple. He's not at Pilate's place, and he's not at Annas and Caiaphas's house. He's at the temple, because he says he throws the money back into the temple.
I mean, I wouldn't use the word Thursday because, you know, it depends on when you think the crucifixion actually happened.
Well, I think it happened on Friday. It wasn't Friday?
Well, I've always argued the fact that it wasn't Friday, but it doesn't matter. I want to take away from the story. Moving on. He's still alive. He's not dead yet. He won't be dead until the following morning.
So I'll keep on my timeline. So Thursday he's traveling. Now, the interesting part is, why wouldn't Herod do anything with him? Now, going back to the sandbox that we started to begin with this, Herod has now already been involved in two different high people's death. He's already tried to kill Jesus through the killing of the people. He's killed Zechariah. He's killed John the Baptist. He beheaded him. He's got a lot of personal blood on his hands that directly relate to the temple. And now he has the man that is considered the king of the Jews and the Messiah.
And the people, all the same people that are following Jesus, also are incensed at Herod because they believe that John was a prophet.
Yes. He already has enough against him that if he does this too and is found out, he's done for, at least by the people's standards. Now, the interesting thing is all this is going on, but we got to keep this along. What about all the people that were in the city?
This episode is brought to you by Supply Chain Solutions.
Supply Chain Solutions is the third-party logistics company providing small to mid-sized businesses an outsourcing option focusing on warehouse management, customization of products, assembly and packaging of goods, and has the ability to meet business-to-business and business-to-consumer fulfillment needs. Supply Chain Solutions continually strive to be their customers' most highly valued partners for quality, delivery, responsiveness, and customer service. To learn more about Supply Chain Solutions, you can visit their website at www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com. That's www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com.
And now back to the show.
They had just Sunday, a few days prior, had ushered him in to the city as their king, their Messiah.
Yeah.
Now, by Wednesday, he's now arrested. He's now being tried privately at night. He's now been courted back and forth. Now he's headed back and forth on a Thursday, back and forth between Herod's house. But nothing in the temple has happened yet. Everybody's happy. There has been no riots. Your main man, the MAGA man, is basically standing in there, and now he's arrested, and nothing happens.
Let's not make Trump and Christ the same. Let's just not do that.
All right. I'll give you a chance to edit out. You there? You're breaking up.
Yes, I am.
Coming back?
Not now.
Yeah, better.
All right. Go for it.
Go ahead and edit that out.
I don't care. I don't need it. Look, you can leave it in there, and I'll say why, because I understand it's the same concept. We just watched in American politics how people, the silent majority, had enough, and they unanimously voted in, you know, Donald Trump to be president because they're tired of the organization, which is something they were trying to prevent, of course. That's what Democrats and Republicans do. In this case, we're talking about...
Let's cut it. It'll mess up. Just cut it.
All right.
So the main man for all the people, the common people that they had ushered in as king, he's arrested. He's being tried. And from the looks of it, eventually he's going to be convicted. And the commoners don't know. They don't know anything about it. I would have thought that if I was a commoner during those days and my Messiah that had healed my family had done all the things that he'd done, and I'd have found out that they'd arrested him. Man, that whole city would have been torn apart trying to find him. But nothing has happened. Nobody knows anything. The disciples have ran and now locked him.
It's the middle of the night. Everybody's asleep.
Except for Thursday. You go through the day, but through the day, he's gone. He's not in the city. Nobody sees him. When he comes back, to Pilate's place, coming back on a Thursday afternoon. So now it's getting close to the evening again. Apparently he stays the night. The next morning on the Friday morning is when they have trial. Now, the way that this is part of my movie story, my sandbox. So the way that we have trial today is every trial and court case is held in a closed setting. It's not open to everybody. Now, there are some caveats because of TV and stuff like that now that it's more broadcasted. But especially going in the back, there was no TVs, there was no nothing. So it was always a closed event. So wherever palace, if for Pilate to have basically court in his palace or where he's at, he has a basically an area that he can present this, or that he had at least every year, because then he would offer a person to be pardoned as a part of, a great gesture to the people to make them favorable towards him. The interesting thing, at least as I see the story, is Pilate doesn't know that the jury's rigged. Pilate confronts Jesus, and this is where it begins to build, that Pilate has a discussion with Jesus and says, "Aren't you the king of the Jews?" And he answers in the same way that he answered, I believe, Annas back in the temptation scene. He answers in a basically a nondescript answer. He neither confirms or denies it. He says, "You say that I am." And then Jesus goes to him and said, but if my people were of this world, that my people would fight for it. The interesting thing is, which the
mafia already knew. They knew that.
Well, but from tradition says that when Jesus said, "My people are not of this world," that they were outer worldly. They were heavenly people. They were not of the earth. My people are not of this earth. But from the context of way Jesus was talking, Jesus had to be telling Pilate, my people, the common people that just ushered me into the city a few days ago as king of this place, they're not of your world, and they're not going to fight to save it when it gets destroyed. And then what's interesting is in Isaiah 2, it talks about where the people would begin to, they would take their swords and they would take their shovels and hooks and beat them into plowshares, that the people would no longer begin to fight. And Jesus is now confirming, based on the prophet Isaiah, that his people will no longer fight because they won't make war anymore. And they don't. They don't fight to save anything. Because Israel is known throughout history as conquerors, world beaters. David beat Goliath, but they would now become, in essence, by the time when the temple would be destroyed, they'd be cowardice and hide within their closet. So Jesus tells Pilate that my people that are standing out there aren't of your world, and they're sure not going to stay, they're not going to fight to save it. So Pilate basically cannot convict him because he hasn't a reason to convict him of anything. Begins to, okay, I'm gonna continue my ceremony that I offer up a person to be pardoned. Pilate offers the worst person he has. But I don't think he recognizes that the jury that he's presenting them in front of him is rigged. They don't care who he's going to put up there. They're not picking Jesus. So they pick Barabbas, the worst man he can bring up. So Jesus becomes falsely convicted by a rigged jury that says we have no king other than Caesar, which, in my opinion, in this sandbox, is that the jurors could not be Jewish. Jews would never say that their king was anybody but who the king of Israel would be. They just announced to the world, bringing Jesus in, that he was king. How in the world did these?
I mean, it's weird because you read in the scripture what Herod is called King Herod. Why wouldn't they say we have no king but Herod?
Right.
They didn't. They said we have no king but Caesar.
So it was a rigged jury.
Yes.
They don't care who he was going to put. They weren't picking Jesus. It was all rigged and scammed. So Pilate washes his hands and says, "Okay, I see it now. I see it for what it is, and I ain't putting this on me." So Jesus then,
he washes his hands.
Washes his hands of the whole situation and says, "Y'all have at it." And so they leave happy. Jesus is turned over to the Roman guards, and then they begin to do something that if you've seen the Passion of the Christ, you've seen what happens. They literally beat him to a pulp.
Yep.
They beat him so bad that he becomes unrecognizable.
Yeah, it's we talked about this before, how it's even prophesied that his visage would be marred. He would not even be recognizable. He could not, no one would know who he was when it was done. He would just be a beaten criminal.
But our tradition tells us that he is beaten for yours and mine iniquities. That's what Paul says.
Yeah.
Which isn't, I'm not going to say Paul's wrong. Not going to say that. By Jewish tradition, he was supposed to get, what, 40 lashes minus one?
Nine. Jewish tradition. It was Roman tradition.
Well, was it Roman 39. Tradition?
39, yeah.
Well, he was supposed to, but he was beaten mercilessly. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you're the listener and you're keeping up with me, why would you beat this man to a pulp so that he was unrecognizable? So by Friday morning, he has trial. He's now begun to be beaten in the daytime. Now he has to be corded out to the area because now he's bleeding to death, basically. He has to be carried out to Golgotha, to the city, to the hillside to be crucified.
Himself, he's been beaten so bad he can't even carry his own cross.
The interesting thing that I find down this sandbox, that Jesus was beaten so bad that the city wouldn't recognize him, that the people that had announced him king wouldn't know it was him. Why would that matter? So that they wouldn't riot.
Yeah.
They wouldn't fight to save
stop unrest.
They basically snuck him out right underneath their noses, the Messiah. Now, you know that we've already said that there's no disciples there. There's no Peter. From the story in the book of John that tells us, there's only a very minute people. I'm only taking assumption or guessing here that there was maybe less than five or less than that knew. Because you knew that Mary the mother was there, Lazarus was there, and was it Mary Magdalene there as well?
Magdalene was there.
Who?
And Mary Magdalene.
Yep. And anybody else?
Yeah. It was, what was her name?
Was it the wife
of
Mary?
Cleophas? There was a wife of Cleophas, yeah.
So, all right. So here's the thing is I think that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was already living with Lazarus and he brought her. He brought her along and then Mary Magdalene, which is his sister, she came too. So you have basically less than five people that know Jesus. And the other part that I find it interesting that's a possibility in my sandbox is that the reason Lazarus was raised from the dead, not only to help bring the commoners in for the sake of controlling the religious leaders on how they handled this with Jesus, was also the fact that he would not run away. He would not turn his face to something that he's already been through and he knows where the outcome is going. Why? For the sake of Jesus's mother. He needed somebody to stay there. Nobody else did, except for him. How could he do that, except for the fact that he went through it? He'd experienced what outside of Christ had no man had experienced that we know. There was other people that were raised, but they never gave us the same type of story that Lazarus had.
This has been a really cool sandbox, bro.
So he goes from the point where Jesus is now crucified. You have him brought down off the cross. Because it's Passover, Joseph, I believe that Joseph of Arimathea is in the city because of Passover, because he's there fast enough to get the body of Jesus down or go to Pilate and ask for the body.
Nicodemus, well, Joseph of Arimathea was a part of the Sanhedrin.
Well, he was there, so he could get. He was
part of the 70.
So he was there in time, so he could be there fast. He knows, Nicodemus knows, because they carry the body, the disciples are still locked away. Peter's don't know where he's at. Lazarus is there. Mother's there. They carry him quietly to a tomb. They place him in a tomb and they seal him up. And the interesting thing is, how many guards did they put by the tomb?
Two.
If that is the Messiah laying in a grave in a tomb, if the city knew about it, it would have taken a battalion of men to stop an army from coming to the tomb to try to get him. There is no way you'd have put just two men over a tomb over a man of that stature. The only way you can do that is if nobody knows about it.
Yeah, because at that point, the mafia has already determined, look, they go to Pilate, right? And they're like, look, his followers are going to come and try and steal his body. We need to seal this baby up. They're not worried about the people anymore. The people are going to be in their Sabbath time. They're not going to be able to do anything. But the followers, they're the breaker of our law. They don't care. They're going to steal, right? So that's why they're sending that Roman soldiers to stand by. Or their own temple guards, actually. It wasn't even the Roman soldiers. It ended up being the temple guards. He said, you can guard it. So, yeah, they've quelled, or at least they think they have, they've quelled this problem.
Yep, there's nobody that knows about it. So by the time we get to Sunday, where the resurrection happens, the only people that come is the two women, the two Marys, to take care of the body and do the things that are necessary. When they get there, they find that the tomb is uncovered and no body. They go from that point, and they go, the first thing that when they meet Jesus, Jesus specifically tells them, we're almost done. We're getting very close. They get done, they meet Jesus, and Jesus tells them that, look, go tell Peter. Peter ran away crying and doesn't know that anything has happened, and he's very distraught. If we don't tell him now, in my opinion, in my sandboxes, he could have pulled off a Judas. He knows enough that's dangerous, but he doesn't know the whole story. Lazarus is not affected because he knows what's going to happen. But for whatever reason, when the ladies get back, I take the assumption that Lazarus and Peter were together, because they're the two people that run back to the tomb after the ladies get back. They go to tell Peter, but Lazarus knows about it now. And by the time...
For those of you who think that it's John, you know, and that it's the Apostle John, I can assure you that it's not. The disciple whom Jesus loved is not the Apostle John. It's got to be Lazarus. It has to be Lazarus.
Yes. Every bit of in me says it's Lazarus now. I cannot unsee all the things that are involved that say that it was the Apostle John. Not that to make him any insignificant. He was very significant in his later ministry, but in this particular story, he's not there. He doesn't play, his person does not fit the role that Lazarus did. When Lazarus got to the tomb first, because he outran John and then made a spectacle of it later in his book, hopefully as a joke, he saw the napkin that he recognized that he had been buried in, and he knew what the deal was. Peter gets to the temple, looks in, and finds that it's done. And now his mind is being accelerated at rapid pace to understand that the things that Jesus had told him now has come to pass. Those things that he said that during the time of the Passover dinner, Jesus told them the story. They didn't believe it. They didn't understand what he was talking about. Scripture clearly says they didn't. But now Peter knows. So Peter leaves the scene. He goes to find the other disciples locked away in a room. They stand. They open the little girl opens the door, sees Peter, slams it back in his face, and goes, "Hey, Peter's standing there," which is a funny story in itself. Peter goes in, and my sandbox is saying that Peter's now telling them all the things that's happened from the time that they ran away on Wednesday to now it's Sunday. It's only been roughly 4.5 days of all the things that's happened to Jesus. Lazarus has now told him, because Lazarus and Peter were together. Lazarus has now told Peter what he saw. Peter has the full story. He goes to tell the 12. They're standing in there believe to me, they were fussing at Peter, believing him that you are lying, Peter. There is no way this man has been killed and he's dead. There's no way it's happened that fast. We're at Passover. You know how many people are here and nobody knows about it? Now you're coming to tell us that they have murdered him and nobody has done anything?
Yep.
That's why I feel in my sandbox that Thomas is looking at Peter and going, unless I see the nail prints in his hands, in his side, I don't believe it.
Yeah.
But guess who walked through the wall and said, hey, Thomas, he ain't lying.
It's wild.
And there's the story of how Jesus went through all that he went through without anybody knowing about it.
Good stuff, man. Well, that was a sandbox.
I don't know how else to say it anymore. Every time I've only told this story a few times to a few select people, and every time I tell it, I get speechless at the end and go, that's why Thomas had to have said, and I think it's an expression, was my Lord and oh my God.
Yeah.
That everything that you were telling us is real.
And see, that's the side of it where some people may not like this sandbox idea because it takes away from the traditions that they've heard. And I can understand that sentiment. But we're not taking away from the miraculous. You have to understand that the entirety of the Old Testament is being fulfilled. All Rick is doing is showing you a way in which it could be. And the way in which God ordained it, the way in which the Son knew exactly what the Father was doing. So there is absolutely miraculous things going on. He is fulfilling prophecy. We're just trying to, you know, we're saying, well, how did they do it? You know, why did it matter that Jesus's visage had to be marred? Why does it matter? Well, in this perspective, it gives you a reason, because they were hiding him. They were getting rid of this problem. It's quite remarkable to think of it that way. You know, and the decoys, you know, you got 12 and then he amps it up to the 70. And there, you know, if you think about it, it's like he is all over the place. What is he doing? And he is really messing up my mob businesses here.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're related to Esau and how that was so long ago and foretold, it's just this massive story about how Christ would bring in this new covenant world. And it's a world that the old world fought like hell to stop.
Yep.
And they didn't succeed.
Not at all. They didn't accomplish anything they intended to accomplish. It was all affected.
And putting a face on the devil, you know, it's weird when you start, because in my opinion, the devil is not just this entity. Sincerely, it's an adversary against God. And there's numerous devils. There's numerous ones throughout Scripture.
Right.
And, you know, you could consider Goliath a devil. You could consider anybody like Nebuchadnezzar or anybody that was against God's people as being an adversary. During the time of Jesus, it was Annas and Caiaphas and the ruling class that was the devil.
Right.
And so, you know, later on in Revelation chapter 2, when he's talking to the church at Ephesus or the church at Smyrna, I think one of the two, it's the church at Smyrna. He says that the devil is about to throw them into prison and they're going to go through a 10-day tribulation. He's not talking about this satanic pitchfork entity. He's talking about an actual person.
Yes.
And most likely it was Nero and the Neronic persecution that came to that church.
Right.
And so Nero would have been a devil in that. He would have been an adversary to God's people.
I mean, it could have been a temple leadership that would have falsely accused him and put him in prison in that way. But it's not the interesting thing, because of our traditions, we've almost made a Disney production out of all these scenes and all these figures to where not intentionally, I'm not saying people didn't anything nefarious, but it's really stretched the truth of what was going on.
Well, the reason why is because the church, by and large, they have such a high Christological view of Jesus that they don't allow him to be a real human being. and they don't allow the human beings that are in the story to have real human lives and real human problems. You know, it's almost like we've taken this and we've placed it up on some pedestal and we look at the highlight reels only, and that tells the whole story. Well, that doesn't tell the story. You know, it's like watching a highlight reel of a football game. You know, right. When I watch football games, I only watch highlight reels. I don't sit and watch the whole game. Yep. It's just like NASCAR, like a NASCAR race. Do you think I'm going to watch them drive 500 miles? Have you lost your mind? I want to see the highlights of when somebody crashed, and then I want to see you got the checkered flag. I don't care about the rest. But those who are in racing, they're going to watch. They're enduring that 500 miles, and every little fender bender, every little tire, every little ounce of gas.
Pit stop that was done. Mm-hmm. There's
much to the story, and we're just looking at the checkered flag,
right?
In the Bible, exactly. We can't do that. We have to put the story together. So, you know, it's still miraculous. Christ still died, and he brought in the access to the tree of life. I mean, this is what Christ did. You know, but it's just a way of looking at it. Fun sandbox, bro. I enjoyed it.
Man, it's crazy, and it's. It's like every time I sit down and start actually looking at it and taking time to digest it, and I look at it again, I keep finding something different.
Yeah. Well, we'll do this again. Lord knows you and I are going to sandbox it.
All the time.
All right. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode, guys.
This one's kind of a long one, I think.
Yes, but it was fun. I enjoyed it. All right, guys. Well, we'll talk to you guys again next time on the Burrows of Berea. Peace out.
Later.
Hey, guys. This is Rick from the Burrows of Berea. A lot of people have been asking us, hey, what is this Patreon thing? Our old Patreon ad didn't work very well. So here you go, guys. Go to www.patreon. That is patreon.com. Let me do that again. patreon.com/TheBurrows of Berea. If you go to the Patreon page, you will find that we have different levels that you can give at. We have a $3 level, a $5 level. We've got a $10 level and a $20 level. I thought about putting a $1,000 level there, but you never know how that's going to work out, right, Andy? That's right. So go to www.patreon.com/TheBurrows of Berea and give us all of your money.
even a little bit will be fine.
Yeah. And that 5,000 wouldn't hurt me.
No, it would hurt nobody.
Thanks, guys.
Hello. How are you doing? How are you? I'm Batman. And it's cold out.
Oh.
Hey guys, this is Andy. Today's episode is